Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This is Writers on Film, the only podcast dedicated to books on cinema.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Writers on Film. My name is John Bleasdale. I'm a writer and film critic, and today I'm talking to Warren Buckland, who is an academic and writer, and he has written a book which will be published in the autumn about the author controversy concerning Citizen Kane between Herman Mankiewicz and Orson Welles. Who wrote Citizen Kane? And we're going to get into it with detailed analysis. If you enjoy the conversation, please remember to like, review, and spread the word as far and wide as you can. There are lots of episodes available now, over 100 episodes available now. So if you have not been with us since the beginning, as many of you have not, then feel free to go back and fish out some of the older episodes, which I will be sort of updating occasionally and putting and reposting as time passes, especially over the summer, as there are lots of festivals to attend, and so it makes releasing new episodes a little bit bumpy to schedule. Can I also put a quick shout out for Cinema Italia, my other podcast, which is going out on a weekly basis. Here we talk about films from the Italian scene, from spaghetti westerns, gialli, epics to neorealism. With enthusiasts, film fans, film critics, directors, and actors. So you can find that if you just Google my name and Cinema Italia. You can find it on all the podcast platforms, popular podcast platforms, I dare to say, Spotify, Amazon, Audible, YouTube, and Apple Podcasts, of course. Okay, but before you do any of that, I've given you way too much to do, haven't I? Before you do any of that, please enjoy the conversation.
I started my PhD at University of East Anglia, supervised by Thomas Alsasso. In fact, halfway through, he actually moved to Amsterdam, and I had a choice to stay in Norwich or to spend my final year in Amsterdam. So I obviously did the latter. So I thought that would be a bit more exciting. So while Thomas Alsasso was setting up film studies in University of Amsterdam in the mid 1990s, you know, I was there as well, finishing my PhD thesis. And going to Amsterdam, you know, opened up a whole vista of, you know, new colleagues. And, you know, I started teaching with Thomas on the MA there. And after several years of teaching on the MA, we began to put our notes together into a book. And that became the book, Studying Contemporary American Film, A Guide to Movie Analysis. So we spent several years teaching that stuff to MA students, and then it came out as a book, which was, you know, halfway between a textbook and a research monograph. And it did quite well. You know, the publisher wanted us to do a second edition, you know, to change all the films, but, you know, that would have been a huge effort. So we said, well, you know, the theory would stay the same, so we might as well, you know, we couldn't really invest the time in doing that. Yeah, I was just saying, out of that really came this idea of the puzzle film, which, again, that came out of that seminar, but when we were studying contemporary cinema and, you know, trying to distinguish puzzle films from other types of films, Thomas developed his own concept of the mind game film. So we had these parallel developments at the same time. We sort of had this sort of playful critique of each other, because he thought my notion of puzzle film was far too narrow, and, you know, and he had a notion of mind game film, which was far broader. Basically, I was just interested in these films from a narratological perspective, and he had a much broader agenda, more cultural, philosophical, historical agenda that he, you know, continued to develop for the next 20 years. And I basically just stuck to narrative theory of these films. It really emerged from watching David Lynch films. Like Lost Highway was really the film that did it for me. Watching Lost Highway several times in you know, midnight screenings in Amsterdam, it is pretty remarkable. You know, going to the films with all these fans to watch Lost Highway, and then trying to figure out, you know, what the film means. And, you know, of course, I always said, well, it's not what it means, it's how it means. And we need to study how, you know, if the film is ambiguous, then we need to study how it is ambiguous, rather than try to shut down the ambiguity and fix it. So we need to acknowledge the ambiguity. So that was really the beginnings of that interest in puzzle films. So, you know, all developed out of that late 90s interest, and just being in Amsterdam with Thomas El Sasso. It was a very creative period for me, very formative.
What was the distinction then between what you were defining as puzzle films and he was defining as mind game films?
For me, well, he interpreted the term puzzle as being you can solve it, can solve the film.
There's an answer.
Yeah, and I never actually meant it in that way, but nonetheless, that was the way Thomas read it. And he, you know, one of his main issues about the mind game film is that it's irresolvable. And you have to acknowledge that there are these fundamental contradictions that you cannot resolve. And for him, the mind game film actually acknowledges that, rather than offering, you know, you can even use Claude Lévi-Strauss and say, you know, the film, puzzle films and mind game films do not offer imaginary solutions to real contradictions. You become aware of those real contradictions.
So there's no. So you're not going to give me the answer to Lost Highway then?
No, I think those who say they can tell you what it means, they're just actually missing, you know, half the film, because they're, as soon as you try to disambiguate it, then you're missing the point.
So. Yeah, David Chase has a similar opinion about the ending of Sopranos. You know, if you think you know the answer, it's you've missed the point entirely.
Yeah.
And yet, I don't know. There's a little bit of me that sort of I think there are some films which sort of look like puzzle films in that definition, but they do have an answer in the sense that, like, something like Christopher Nolan's Inception, I think it's very clear that there is a very distinct and specific answer, and he's using a sort of editing device, i.e. he's cutting before what would be revealing happens, just in order to maintain a sense of ambiguity rather than because there's any genuine ambiguity.
Well, if you have a $200 million budget, then you have to offer some solution to the audience, I guess. That's the problem when the mind game film or puzzle film elements then enter the mainstream, then obviously they're compromised. You know, David Lynch obviously didn't compromise with Lost Highway or indeed with Mulholland Drive, but you know, Christopher Nolan is sort of using them within a more traditional narrative structure. You know, you could be harsh.
Just to push back a little bit on that, I mean, I think I have certain problems with Nolan, definitely. But I mean, if anything, things like Dunkirk and Tenet, he seems to be constantly spending a lot of money on plots which are sort of bafflingly complex in his, you know, I mean, unnecessary. I mean, Dunkirk could easily have just been a fairly straightforward war film, and he chose not to do that. So I'm not sure how much he's compromising there.
Yeah, I think Tenet, he didn't compromise.
Yeah.
I think it's people just say it's baffling, but then that you know, with this large budget, and I think that's part of its strength, actually, that he actually went ahead with it. Yeah, I think you know, some people say it's, you know, they criticize it, and I think it's if they do, then I think it's an underrated film. You know, much more challenging and complex than Inception. So, yeah, I'd much prefer, you know, Tenet to Inception in that sense.
Yeah. And so so now you're working on this new book, which, oh, you've finished this new book, which is on the authorship. I mean, this is a different kind of puzzle in a way, the authorship of Citizen Kane, which has been, you know, argued about for decades and recently re-emerged with the film Mank by David Fincher, written by his father, that rehearsed some of the arguments for believing that Mankiewicz, Herman Mankiewicz, is that right?
Yeah.
Was more the author than Orson Welles had let on. So what's your approach?
I guess I should point out what I'm trying to avoid. Firstly, you know, all the debates around Citizen Kane authorship, they're you know, completely subjective. They're impressionistic. They're based on confirmation bias. That it's people saying, well, I knew Wells, therefore I know the truth of this, which clearly isn't, you know, if it was a court case, it wouldn't stand up in court, just saying, well, I know this person did it. You know, you need independent evidence.
Yeah, assertion is not argument.
Yeah. After reading all of these accounts of the to and fro between various people and their critiques of each other, I thought, well, you know, we can take this to a completely different level and look at it in terms of the evidence that we do have, which are the various versions of the screenplay, and then use statistics to to measure and quantify the authorship, because that is possible. You know, you can go all the way back to Aristotle, who said, you know, he defined style in terms of the writer's identity, and says, you know, the writer can claim a piece of text because as part of their identity exists within the text, so they can claim it. And ever since then, it's, you know, we've been defining style. And the issue is, we really need evidence for, you know, measuring style. These are the two things: the measuring the style and quantifying it. And then, when you've got a dispute between two authors, you can then compare them in terms of the style that has been quantified. So once you've reduced it to a numerical value, you can make comparisons. So rather than just making assertions. Yeah.
So how do you reduce style to a numerical value?
Yeah, that is part of the complex part of the book, but I try to go through it as simply as I can. Okay, so as I said, the key is then quantifying linguistic features of style. And, you know, the basic way of quantifying style is to count the frequency of linguistic features, you know, letters, words, different word types, pronouns, and even punctuation. You know, punctuation is actually quite important when you're defining authorship. If you have two authors like Wells and Mankiewicz, you can identify these particular linguistic features that have a high frequency in one author and a low frequency in the other author. So those are the linguistic features that we're looking for. So these are called the distinctive linguistic features because their frequencies are different in both authors. Now, obviously, you can use statistics to then measure that difference because some differences are significant and some are not significant, but I can get onto that later. To identify the author's star, then I needed a control group. So I managed to collect 40,000 word samples from each author's other screenplays. Then use software to generate the frequency of all linguistic features, from letters, punctuation, words, and two-word collocations. You know, I did this systematically. I just focused on, you know, letters first of all, looked at all the differences, and then moved on to words. You know, this took several weeks. So you generate these huge lists of features and their relative frequency. The relative frequency simply means the frequency of this feature in relation to the whole data set. So it's 40,000 word sample, and then you just, you know, count a particular word and divide the word into that 40,000 word sample, then you get the relative frequency. So I did this for both authors, just compared them, and I eventually identified 44 linguistic features that have a high frequency in one author and a very low frequency in the other author. So that's the statistical profile of each author. And, you know, it's very mundane. It's words like day and the and full stop, you know, things like that. But, you know, you have no idea what you're going to come up with. It really is a process of discovery of seeing what distinguishes Wells from Mankiewicz. So I eventually got these linguistic profiles, so these 44 words that have high frequency in Wells and low frequency in Mankiewicz, and actually the other way around. It gets quite complicated because that's not the same. But once you've got that profile, I then compared it to the frequency of those 44 linguistic features. I then looked for those features in the Citizen Kane screenplay, and then counted, you know, their frequency, and then compared it to the frequency in Wells and their frequency in Mankiewicz. And I did that three times. So I just compared their profiles to the whole screenplay of Citizen Kane. I then divided into 4,000 word segments. So I ended up with 7 segments. And then the film is divided into 13 major scenes. So I then compared the profiles to the 13 major scenes, which again generates huge amounts of data. Now, a lot of procedural issues here. I can actually give you an example. We may lose everybody.
Go ahead. This is interesting.
You know, the way I've described it, you can raise a lot of objections.
Sure.
But I was aware of all of the issues and problems involved. So this is why it took a long time. You know, I then made sure that I didn't fall into the usual traps. So let me give an example of the word that is very distinctive, and it's the word day. Okay, I'll begin with the end result. The word day has a distinctive ratio of 3.41, which basically means Mankiewicz uses it, you know, 3.41 times more than Wells does.
Right.
Okay. And if we look at the numbers in the 40,000 word sample for Mankiewicz, you know, he uses the word day 79 times. Orson Welles, in his 40,000 word sample, uses the word day 23 times. Now, okay, those are raw figures, but because the data sets are the same size, we can make a direct comparison there. But obviously, Citizen Kane is a different sample size. It's 26,000 words, basically. So to compare different sample sizes, you simply convert them to a percentage. So this is why we use percentages, because it standardizes the results, so we can compare samples of different size. So the 79 uses of the word day in Mankiewicz in his 40,000 word sample, you know, it comes to 0.198%. And again, remember, percent means out of 100, so he uses it 0.198 times per 100 words. And Wells, it's obviously even smaller, because he uses the word day 23 times in his 40,000 word sample. So it becomes a very small percentage of 0.058. Okay, so now I look at Susan Cain, and I found the word day 60 times.
Right.
But 60 times in a sample size of 26,000 words. So we can't make any direct comparison with raw figures. We have to convert it to a percentage. And the percentage then is 0.232 percent. Now, another thing here is to keep talking about these very small numbers can be very tedious. But as I said, I'm talking about a percent, so per 100. And if we want to stop talking about 0.0 whatever, we can actually sort of scale them up. So rather than per 100, we can say, per 1,000. So the 79 uses of the word day in Mankiewicz becomes, 1.98 per 1,000. But even that's a bit awkward. So why don't we just keep scaling it up and go to 100,000? So we scale it up to 100,000. So we get Mankiewicz using the word day 198 times per 100,000 words. Wells is 58 times per 100,000 words, and Citizen Kane, it is 232 times per 100,000 words. Now, just quoting those figures, you can see that Citizen Kane is higher than Mankiewicz and Wells, but Citizen Kane is much closer to Mankiewicz than it is to Wells. Citizen Kane, 232, is very close to Mankiewicz is 198, and Wells is all the way down to 58. But obviously, quantifying it that way isn't enough as well. That's very informal. So what we do is we actually do what we did earlier with the, we just use the ratio again. We just divide one into the other. You know, when we looked at relative frequency, you know, I just divided 79 into 40,000, and we got the, the percentage. So we can do this again. We just divide Mankiewicz's frequency into Citizen Kane and Wells's frequency into Citizen Kane. So the Citizen Kane frequency is 232. The Mankiewicz is 198. Divide one into the other. That's all you have to do. And you end up with 1.17, which is, as a ratio. Then do the same with Wells. And again, obviously put them in the same order. So 232 divided by 58, and you get 4. Now, if you had a ratio, if that figure came out as 1, it would be identical. You would say that these two samples are identical. So Citizen Kane has 232 per 100,000 words. Now, if the sample I was comparing it to also had 232, that would give you, you divide one into the other. It's obviously 232 divided into 232, you get one. And so a ratio of one would suggest identity, complete identity between the two samples. So obviously you don't get complete identity here, but 1.17 is pretty close. That's the Mankiewicz. But Wells is four. That's completely different. Basically, what that means is that Citizen Kane, there are four times more uses of the word a day than there are in Wells. And in Mankiewicz, there's 1.17 or more or less in terms of Citizen Kane.
Could it be argued that, I mean, I can think of several objections here, and I'm assuming that what you're doing is you're doing this over and over again with lots and lots of different things, and so that
you can't do this with one word. I'm just giving one word as an example. So I do 44 words, and those 44 words, and then I average out all of these ratios, and then you get a final ratio, and so that is the. So that's how you work. That's how you work it out.
So what are your conclusions then?
Well, I just point out that then in the next chapter, I then visualize this by putting it onto a confidence interval.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I won't go into that. It would get more complicated. But so I actually create these graphs. But you can imagine a graph where one, again, it's if you reach the ratio of one, that means identity. So you just plot Mankiewicz and Wells on this graph. And so for the word day, Mankiewicz would be very close to that one, and Wells would be all the way up at the top of the graph. So the closer you get to that ratio of one, the closer the authorship. As I said, I did that for 44 words and, combined all the different ratios. And I ended up, as I said, I did this three times. And I just talk about the 13 scenes version. And what I discovered, a certain pattern there that, Orson Welles's statistical linguistic profile is dominant in four out of those 13 scenes. And those four scenes, one of them is very problematic, but it's the first three scenes of the film. So the prologue, News on the March, and then the scene after it in the projection room. And then after the projection room scene, the film then moves into Thompson going to interview everybody. And that's where the signature, stylistic signature, changes dramatically, where Mankiewicz's signature suddenly becomes much more dominant in the screenplay. Now, Wells' signature becomes dominant in the last scene as well, when Thompson is summarizing Kane's life. They're in the basement and they're looking at all this stuff in the basement. And Thompson gives this speech about, how to sum up somebody's life. Well, that's where Orson Welles's signature reappears. So the prologue scene, it's written in a very literary manner. And there's one word of dialogue, of course, just Rosebud. But it was written as almost a bit as a novel. And there's absolutely no trace of Mankiewicz in there at all. So Wells clearly wrote that. Now, people say, OK, that's in the first draft of the screenplay. But, you know, Wells and Mankiewicz met before Mankiewicz started to write the first draft. And I imagine that Wells then, you know, wrote this prologue and said, well, this is how it's going to begin. And then we're going to have a news on the march. And then they'll be in the projection room. And basically then he gives Mankiewicz instructions then to, you know, to write the rest of the screenplay. But except for the summary right at the end of the film. So as I said, I charted all these frequencies on the graph. So all the frequencies are close to Wells in scenes 1, 2, 3, and 13. And then he suddenly veers off when we get to the main part of the screenplay. Now, there are obviously are variations. there are very small variations. You know, when Thompson is interviewing Leyland in this nursing home, you know, there's a little blip on the graph which suggests that Wells actually wanted to intervene here and wanted to make sure that this was right. You know, it's actually a very comical scene where Leyland is avoiding all of Thompson's questions and says, you know, can you get me some cigars? You know, put them in, disguise them and try to sneak them in. And while Thompson is trying to ask him about Kane. And I think all of that humour, then, you know, sort of an indication of Wells actually intervening to say we need to, you know, because that's the key, one of the key to the films, actually, is that relationship between Kane and Leyland. And Wells really wanted to get that right. So I imagine he strongly edited those moments.
Okay, let me play devil's advocate then. I know that this sort of statistical analysis has been used on things like Shakespeare's plays to establish authorship, and especially things like Macbeth. You know, various parts of Macbeth have now been included in Thomas Middleton's collected works because analysis has proved quite decisively that there are whole scenes that Thomas Middleton wrote. However, with Shakespeare, all we have are the plays. We don't have the performances. Instead, with Citizen Kane, we have the film. So the argument of authorship, the text, doesn't have the relationship to us as it does with Shakespeare's plays. So couldn't it be argued that authorship is not necessarily located in the screenplay, albeit seventh draft, but is located on the screen?
Well, firstly, with the Shakespeare, it's, you know, there's a lot of documentation that, you know, Shakespeare, like many other playwrights, co-authored screenplays, the plays, because they were very busy. Exactly, you know, the same thing happened with Citizen Kane. You know, Shakespeare was, didn't have time to write a whole play. So, you know, he collaborated with others. And the collaboration comes down to the fact that, you know, Shakespeare say, well, you write these scenes and I write the other scenes and we won't edit each other's work. So that's why you can detect authorship, multiple authorship in Shakespeare's plays, especially the late ones. You know, we're talking about the late, you know, there is a very famous book that's dealt with this by Brian Vickers called Shakespeare Co-Authorship. It's a 500-page volume, and I used it as one of my main texts because, you know, it's Shakespeare co-author. So and he uses some statistical analysis there, and, you know, he's a renowned Shakespeare scholar. And obviously with Citizen Kane, you know, Wells was at RKO and developing these projects, and none of them were working. So his he's on his, he's there for almost a year and he hadn't made a film. So he's starting to panic because he wasn't fulfilling his contract. So he came up with, well, I'd have to hire somebody to help me write a screenplay in order to, you know, fulfill the RKO contract. So then he started his collaboration with Mankiewicz. So obviously Wells would, control, the tone of the film by saying, well, here were the opening scenes. As I said, one of them is problematic. The News on the March is very problematic. It looks like Wells, but we have documentation that, of course, John Houseman said that he wrote it several times. But at the same time, it's imitating the voiceover of, News on the March. It's just a genre thing.
And just a coincidence.
Yeah, and it just sounds like, Wells's dialogue, Wells's fingerprint. But anyway, that's what I think happened when they met before Mankiewicz started writing, is that Wells set up the whole project. So here's the prologue and here's the opening scenes, and this is how it has to end with this final scene. And then Mankiewicz was then tasked with writing the main scenes, which of course were then heavily edited by Wells, by cutting a lot of material. But of course, if you cut material, that your authorial signature doesn't suddenly appear, you see. That's the problem. That's one of the objections with, Wells did a great deal of creative work by editing and cutting and revising someone else's writing, but the original author's signature is still there. And to get back to your question, that yes, Wells is an auteur in terms of filmmaking, but we're treating the screenplay as a separate entity, as a text. So we're looking at the screenplay in itself as a text to analyze. So obviously Wells did excel in terms of directing, but several of his biographers say that's where he really excelled, but he didn't really excel when it came to writing. That's the more tedious part of creativity. It also goes back to the War of the Worlds, radio play. it's actually adapted by somebody else and who wrote it. And actually, it did go to court. Mm. Wells lost because, the text was written by, was it Kosh, who he's hired to write the text. But the reason why, everybody panicked is because the way it was staged by Orson Welles in the radio studio. But when you look at the text, it was written by somebody else who's, of course, adapting another text. So, that's the issue. Where do you locate authorship? Wells worked on radio for several years, but every one of them was an adaptation.
Mm.
One of his first adaptations was, Victor Hugo, the Miserable, but, a huge novel. And, his main job was to cut it, just cut out these snippets. Literally, he would cut them out and paste them onto the screenplay. He didn't even write them out. He just cut and paste the bits that he wanted in the screenplay. So he was very good at editing text. But of course, there's no stylistic signature in that. It could be thematic. He picked particular moments. But in terms of language and style, his signature isn't there.
Well, he did it as a teenager. He was cutting for when he was at Todd's Academy for Boys. He was cutting all of Shakespeare's history plays into a King's Cycle, which is like absolutely, the gall of the man. At least he wasn't claiming authorship, but he was.
Yeah, but editing Shakespeare in his while still a teen. Yeah.
And then he comes back with Chimes of Midnight, perhaps one of the best Shakespeare plays ever put to cinema, which is continuing that process of just chopping up Shakespeare's plays and putting his favorite bits together as much an interpretation as it is a thing. So, I come back to the answer is to the question is yes, Victor Hugo wrote the novel on which he based the radio play. Yes, this other writer wrote the radio script from which it was based. Yes, Herman Mankiewicz co-wrote the screenplay. I mean, that isn't necessarily even controversial. It's on the screen. But the authorship of the film, I mean, you could argue it's a three-hander. You know, Greg Toland shares the title card with the director, which is extraordinary at the time, that the director would share a title card with the director of photography.
Yeah, it's a different research question. Yeah, it's, you know, treating the screenplay as as an entity in itself, rather than with the finished film. It's something that's developed recently of screenplay studies. It's not how to write a screenplay, but using the screenplay as an object of study and then promoting the writer within film studies, rather than always focusing on the director.
Does that extend to like unmade screenplays as well?
Yeah, one of my samples is actually an unmade screenplay, but which is even better. One of Mankiewicz's screenplay that I used for like 40,000 word sample. It wasn't even made into a film, but that means it wasn't edited by anyone. He wrote the screenplay, and then they said, "Well, we can't make this," so it didn't go through a production process, didn't go through rewrites. So it's more authentically his. So same with a Wells film screenplay, the Big Brass Ring. So it's obviously it was made later by somebody else, but the way he wrote it, it's a text that nobody else edited.
I think it's fascinating, actually. I remember talking to Charles Eldon, I think it was last year, about Michael Cimino. And Michael Cimino had a room in his house which was just, you know, to the floor to ceiling with written screenplays that he'd never stopped writing since Heaven's Gate, but just didn't have the opportunity to ever film. And the idea that I got was that the minute he died, they just all became worthless because there was no one's going to go in there and go through those screenplays and actually make a film out of them. It was just like, I guess it's a bigger version of what happens whenever anybody dies. Suddenly, all the stuff in their life, in their house, just becomes, you know, charity shop fodder.
To go back to this question of Wells's authorship, you know, him, you know, the Writers Guild of America, you know, defines authorship of a screenplay in terms of, you know, the first author must have written about 50% of it and so on. So, you know, they measure authorship in terms of percentages as well. And indeed with copyright law, I had a fun time going through United States copyright law, trying to, you know, make sense of it. But in the end, they say it's not the ideas, you can't copyright ideas, you can only copyright the expression of ideas as manifest in a text. So This is why Wells lost the copyright legal challenge, because he didn't write the text. You know, he did something far more powerful, which was the staging of that for radio. But the writing of the text itself, he doesn't own the copyright on it.
So what does this as a research subject? How can you apply this to people's understanding? Is it just settling those questions once and for all, or in terms of the historical record, or how is it?
Yeah, if you think about what we do in arts and humanities, we just basically pick our favorite films and then write about them as if they are, you know, the defining feature, you know, the defining nature of cinema. You know, Andre Bazin did this all the time, but we all do this to some extent. That, all our work is really, is completely inflected with, confirmation bias. And, you know, obviously I've done this as well, but I get to a point where I say, well, do I want to now, you know, write another analysis proving that, you know, David Lynch makes puzzle films, you know? And, you know, students do this as well. And I try to say, well, it's confirmation bias. It's a closed question. And you need to open yourself up to the fact that your question may have a different answer. So I'll just give an example that students do all the time. It's, we do feminist analysis. And mm-hmm. so a student says, I'm going to pick this, I'm going to look at this film and prove that it's a patriarchal film. And obviously you say, well, you've already come to your conclusion. So what's the point? And, you know, if you state your conclusion like that, you said, well, all you're going to do is just cherry pick data and say, well, that there we are. See, I've proved my point. And I say to students, so it needs to be an open question. You say, okay, I'll take this film and ask, is it a patriarchal film or is it not? Or where is it? Is there some scenes patriarchal or not patriarchal? So it should be an open question. The way you approach it is then you say, okay, I'm going to use a particular theory and a particular method and apply that, and I will find out. I don't know what the answer will be. I will find out by applying a particular theory. And according to the principles of that theory, it will either be patriarchal or not. And then you can say, well, we use a different theory and then we come to a different answer. So we avoid relativism by saying it can be anything you like, because it's always grounded in a particular theory and method. Mm. We're not saying it's universal. We're saying it's relative to that theory and method. If you follow the method, you will get a particular result. You can use a different method and you can get to a different result, and then you can compare them. The same with Citizen Kane. If you want me to put it bluntly, I don't care who wrote it. That really is, I don't care. I don't have any vested interest in promoting Orson Welles or Mankiewicz. Now, I know if I start, you know, my results give Mankiewicz the edge. You know, more of it was written by Mankiewicz than Welles, you know, using my methods. And, you know, it's going to get me into trouble with Welles aficionados. If I said, oh, yeah, it's almost all Welles, then, you know, there won't be any Mankiewicz supporters coming after me. Perhaps, I guess, David Fincher is sort of a supporter of Mankiewicz, but, you know, it's very much a minority. So, yeah, my results are going to annoy a few, you know, Welles. But I tell them, OK, you may have known Welles, but, you know, here's the actual results. He was a good storyteller. You know, there's these famous stories about him in the 70s sitting in the same restaurant telling these stories about his past to everyone who came to his dinner table. And, yeah, he's a great storyteller. But, you know, if you think about it in legal terms, in a court of law, it's, you know, you need the evidence, not just great stories.
About that, in terms of the writing, Welles often used dictation as part of his writing. Does that in any way influence your results?
No, somebody did a study of Henry James. You know, he developed a cramp in his hands, and for the last few of his novels, he actually dictated them as well. And, you know, with Henry James, you imagine his incredibly long, complex sentences. You think, well, if he's no longer writing it but dictating it, they must have changed. And so someone did a very careful study of before he hired, before he hired a stenographer and afterwards, and there's absolutely no difference. That's partly due to the remarkable nature of, you know, Henry James is right, that those complex sentences were in his head and he could dictate them. That's absolutely, unusual. I guess it's unusual for him, you know, so it's a special case. But yeah, he did dictate his later novels, and there's no stylistic difference between them. You can't tell that there's a difference. But, you know, Mankiewicz was doing the same. You know, when we see it in the film Mank, he's, he's got a broken leg and he can't do very much. So he's, you know, again, he's dictating. Yeah, obviously we know that it's such a long, prolix draft that he produced, and it had to be very carefully edited out. But again, if you edit someone's work, that your stylistic signature still doesn't appear.
Okay, well, that's fascinating. I mean, I hope it's definitely going to be contribute to the argument. I don't necessarily think it's going to stop the argument definitively, but it will contribute and make us all regard it in a way which is a bit more refreshingly objective. I agree with your idea of the confirmation bias being not altogether helpful in this case. One last question, Warren. Do you have a film book that you'd like to recommend to our listeners?
Well, if they want to be challenged, earlier I talked about Thomas Alsasser's work on the Mind Game film. Thomas unfortunately died quite suddenly in 2019, and he had this unfinished manuscript, which was on the Mind Game film. And so I decided, along with a few other colleagues, you know, Dana Polin and Song Hoon and Thomas's widow, that we would finish this project for him. And this actually happened during the COVID lockdowns. You know, firstly, I was actually doing this cane work at home during the COVID lockdown. It's, you know, it's actually a good time to sit down, relearn statistics, and do all this incredible counting of words during lockdown, because I couldn't go out anyway. But the second thing I was doing was helping to edit Thomas's final book, the Mind Game film. We had this the three editors and then Sylvie, Thomas's widow. We had this email group, and we were literally emailing each other almost every day about Thomas's book, the Mind Game film. And we spent a year editing it, and then it was published. And you know, it's a culmination of Thomas's thinking about the Mind Game film. And it's just such an overwhelming book anyway, but I would recommend that if, you know, you really want a challenge. So, you know, Thomas's posthumously published book, The Mind Game Film.
Brilliant.
Which that's my recommendation.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Warren. And thanks so much for taking your time to talk to us today.
Okay. Okay. Thanks.